they're more than you figure they're worth.
Does that make sense?
In other words, it's like, let's say you have thieves. Everything that the thieves have is stolen. But the thieves don't steal from each other, and everything's fine. As long as they're stealing outside the community, no one in the community will be bothered. Right? But as soon as one thief steals from another thief, then they'll be punished by the thieves for stealing. You know, seeming contradiction, but there. So therefore, you have the same principle as in the material sphere. We don't think like that. The problem we pointed out is that everybody's stealing because they may be taking it from nature, and then who's in charge of nature? Who does the nature belong to? Right. So it belongs to God. So everybody is stealing because they're taking what is in nature and claiming it is theirs. Right. You just go out and pick it up and walk back, you know, and say, this is mine. Right? So, therefore, the Upanishad then points out that everyone has their quota. So if you're taking within God's creation according to your quota, then it's not considered stealing, even though it's God's. God has given you that, you use that, apply it properly, it's not stealing. So with this kind of thing, then you can accommodate every living entity. But otherwise, if we drop the viewpoint, you know, to, I say, what do they call it? Critical analysis, like that, you know, like the academics will use, or other persons who come in and analyze something, much of the time they'll just throw everything out. Especially academics, because they don't have to do anything practical with the knowledge, right? There's no rule. All they have to do is they study, they got the degree, then they teach others to study and get a degree. For the purpose of getting others to study and get a degree. But nothing gets done. Does that make sense? So they don't have, it doesn't have to be practically applied. So then they're being able to analyze something critically, then supposedly is a benefit. But what benefit? Because they're not doing anything with the knowledge anyway. So that's the point, is that therefore this critic, he just says it's useless, it has to be thrown out. Someone who is practical, who actually does something with the material energy, they generally will never throw anything out. They'll only throw out what part is can't be used to accomplish the goal that they're trying to get to. Right? The academic doesn't have a goal other than to study knowledge, increase his knowledge. But there's nothing practical to be done with it. Does that make sense? Do you understand the point? So here is then he's saying you have to start all over again. But who would say you have to start all over again except for someone who doesn't know the field? Right? Or someone who is really in the mode of passion and is willing to throw out everything and themselves start it from the beginning and bring it up to whatever it is. I'm saying like that. But that's, you know, only a few very passionate people. But otherwise, you go in and what's there, you work with what's there. Right? Does that make sense? You know, you go into the kitchen, you know, there's two potatoes, half a cauliflower, one carrot, you know, a couple of beans, and then you just go, you know, so you gotta cook lunch. This is useless. It's not enough to make anything. So then you just take it, throw it out, and then go to the market and buy new stuff. Right? So that would be one way of doing it. The other is, okay, we got a little bit of everything, so I can't make any one, you know, a cauliflower, a bean, or a potato, but if I mix them, I can make a lafla, which is a traditional mixed vegetable preparation. So therefore, that's going in and working with what's there. You may have had so many ideas, I'm going to cook this. When you go in the kitchen, you see, oh, this is what's here. Right? And so then that's what you do. Does that make sense? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur is making the point that whatever position one's in, whatever the interest, whatever the nature is, you start with that. Right? And from there, then you try to take that and connect it to Krishna. So you have to be able to understand what it is. Not necessarily means the form has to be taken into consideration because the person sees form. right? But it's more important, what's the form representing? Why is that form manifest? What it is that they want, therefore they're using that form. Does that make sense? Because it's said that the living entity, they have a mentality, right, of the mind. And then for the next lifetime, then the subtle body then creates a kind of nose, ear, eye, mouth, you know, tongue, you know, skin that matches that mentality. Then when you take a gross body, then that's manifest. But that form is not the soul. Right? It's a mentality, therefore that manifests. You change the mentality, technically you change the form. Right? But it's, so that's why the form is not important, is this is the form from your previous mentality. Your present mentality will give you the form in the next body. But you don't have to wait for the next body to act in that way. You can act like that now. Does that make sense? So he's saying is that, therefore, then the person, the shallow critic, and the person who just studies to study, right? You know, in other words, the perpetual student, you know, who actually doesn't use the knowledge, and the critic, who just, you know, therefore, you know, breaks everything down and says everything's useless, you have to always start over, then both of these are public enemies. Because they won't allow the public to get it. Right? They do nothing, they don't allow anybody else to do it. So he's making this point, is that any thought, therefore, has a use, but you have to be find out what that use is. You're starting from somewhere. So having started from that point, you find out what is useful in that thought. Details may not be useful, but there may be something behind it that's important. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's like they want to save the whales. Okay, now saving a whale or not saving a whale, that's not specifically the point. But a living entity having compassion upon another living entity, you know, and seeing their needs and appreciating that and trying to help them with that, that's useful. Right? So then you can take the person who is into saving the whale, and therefore they want to do welfare work. You don't say, oh, this is nonsense, you know, why is this saving the whales, this sad, this is useless, why don't you do something useful? No. You want to save them, that means you have compassion for other living entities. You've chosen this one, what about others? And what you're going to give them, you may give them a habitat, this and that, but, you know, then, you know, something may happen anyway, you know, like that. You know, you save them from the oil tankers, and then the Japanese trawler comes and takes them away, you know, like that. Or you've gotten rid of the trawler, and then, you know, the 10-year-old comes by, and there's a little jet boat, you know, and runs them over. You know, so, you know, like this kind of thing is, you can't guarantee. So the element of welfare work is good. So if you're going to do welfare work, why settle for something less than the best? So the best welfare work you could do is teaching people about God consciousness, who they are, so they can eternally situate themselves, right? You're trying to create a habitat for, a safe habitat for whatever living entity you want to perform welfare for, right? You're trying to improve their environment, right? Isn't that what welfare is, right? By clothes or food or a house or a situation, you know, or bigger, the ecology or something. You're trying to create a safe habitat in which someone can perform their activities. You're not getting involved in their activities. You're simply trying to create a safe environment. So what more safe environment is that there for the living entities, all of them, than the spiritual world, right? So you're trying to create that. That is the highest welfare activity. So this person who is dedicated to welfare simply has to understand this is a higher welfare. Therefore, it's not a problem. Does that make sense? So this is what he means, is you don't throw the thing out, you find out what's of use in the thing, keep that, and then they're inspired. He says, yes, I am into welfare, but this is higher welfare. They'll be more inspired. Oh, your welfare is useless, so they'll throw it out. So then what goes with that? Compassion, kindness, wanting to help others, the mood to sacrifice your own time or money for others. So if you throw out all that, how much devotional service does someone do? Right? They're living at home, they won't give money, won't give time. Right? You know, if somebody does something wrong, finish them off. You know, so it doesn't matter because you've ruined all these qualities. Does that make sense? Because they identify with them. They identify with them, I'm a welfare person. Therefore, you break that identity. What do they have left? Have you replaced it? You just say, oh, that's nonsense. So that if you break that, then what do you have left? No, you have to take that. You had this, now take it further. Make it real. You know what I'm saying? So that's you transform it. Like it's just like, okay, the guy's dressed as a punk, you know, with a green, you know, mohawk or something like that. Great. So why is he doing that? Right? Either he's trying to make a statement, or he actually feels it looks attractive, you know, or there's an element of uniqueness, or, you know, something special that he makes himself special. You know, no one else that he knows has a green mohawk. The guy's got, you know, orange ones or white ones, you know, but no one has an orange one, right? So then you take all those things. You want to be unique. You know, what about, you know, a Hare Krishna? You know, you don't see them around anywhere. You know, if it's concept of beauty, but then what is that higher beauty? What is more? You know, like that. So Krishna is the most beautiful. Therefore, his culture, his everything is the most beautiful. You know? You want to be, individual, express yourself. Then what's more of that than self-realization? And then giving that to others. You're taking your self-realization and giving it to others. Right? So does that make sense? So you can take the same drive they have and just turn it into something else. Otherwise, they say, oh, this is stupid and all that. Then they don't bother about dressing nicely. Right? They're afraid of being an individual. Right? They can't be seen out on the street with their, you know, the bed sheets and their bald head. Like before, they could go out there with a mohawk and it's green and they couldn't care less what people thought. Now they can't go out in a dhoti or a sari. Why? Because that whole conception has been destroyed rather than transformed. You understand? We have transformed from the spiritual to the material. So it's a matter of transforming it back. Everything's supposed to transform back, at least as far as living entities go. I mean, dead matters for the state. We leave it for those who come after. Yes.
So does that mean that to actually transform something, there must be some activity happening?
Yes, there's an action.
So it's like that's the constructive critique or.
Yeah, constructive critic is finding the alternative that gets done what they in the core they want to do, but it has a form that's more useful. In other words, the principle that they're basing it on is good. The form maybe may or may not have much use. Does that make sense?
It's basically directing the energy, directing and just adjusting it, but letting it flow.
Yeah, but you're adjusting it so now it points at Krishna. It's moving, but now you just adjust it so it keeps moving, it goes towards Krishna. You don't stop it and tell it to go all the way back, because then you're wasting time, energy, identity, everything. Because you're dealing with the conditioned nature. It has an identity, it has to work within them. That's why the whole Vedic system is there, as having such a broad range of activities for a living entity to do. Right? There's so many things that the living entity can do. But, and why is it that broad? Because that's how broad the nature is of human beings.
And the other critic, then, he doesn't see use of the activity.
Because he only sees form. See, one critic sees form only. The other one sees that there's a form, but that form he uses as the means to get to what his purpose was behind that form. He keeps that purpose, which is actually what the living entity was trying to accomplish. And then he redirects that so it's connected to Krishna. So then with that redirection, it may be because that, you know, you engage their purpose in Krishna's service. The form may be useful. If it's not, to what degree it's not useful, it's readjusted. that. So if you're going too far to the right, then you point it to the, you know, where Krishna is, then you're going. Where Krishna is. It goes, misses, goes to the left, you point it back. So you just keep going until it gets there. So otherwise, then you'd have to say, if anybody makes a mistake any time, then they're finished. Right? Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, it depends. If you go kind of like next to Sweden, kind of, they don't mind being finished. Oh, you know, you've got a finished passport. Got to finish. So if that was true, then why would we be given an opportunity to take up devotional service? Because we already are faulty, right? We're already not involved in Krishna's service. That's already a major mistake, right? So then you'd have to throw everybody out, as Nityananda Prabhu said, you know? Or as Duryodhana recommended, right? The Yudhishthira, he couldn't find any totally bad person. Everybody had some good quality to work with. So that's the whole point. You find a spark, you fan it. You can't go, oh, it's just a spark, you know. You know, start all over again, bring the matches. No, it's a spark. Fan it, it'll make fire. Does that make sense? So that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakura is pointing out. Because we have to remember, the people he moved with, these were all the top academic, political, and religious leaders, probably economic leaders of his time. They were directing where India was going, the whole country. Right? Does that make sense? I mean, still, like Rabindranath Tagore is remembered because of his Nobel Prize, very influential. Started a university. The Prime Minister of India is still the Chancellor of that university. You know what I'm saying? So his elder brother was Bhaktivinoda Thakura's friend, associate. Does that make sense? So that means Rabindranath, he was the kid. His older brother, he was the more prominent. Right? Rabindranath came later. He was there. So that class of people is where Bhaktivinoda Thakura was moving. You know, so an academic's an academic, just like a politician's a politician. A warrior is a warrior. So it's the same, you know. Does that make sense? Yeah. Therefore, his instructions are relevant. Does that make sense? They're very relevant. Because anything that is relevant to the moment, the present moment, is always relevant. Because there's always the present. Does that make sense? This is probably a very little known fact to practically every living entity on the planet. This present is always present. So if it applies to the present, you know how to deal with the present, then you can always deal with it. It doesn't matter if you were present 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, or you're present now or in the future. The point is that you're present. And only if you're present can you do something. Does that make sense? You're carrying that. What is that?
Okay.
The true critic, on the other hand, advises us to preserve what we all have already obtained. Means what you have obtained. You know what I'm saying? Not what you're saying you're going to attain, but you haven't. But what is actually obtained. Because that is the present. That's what you have. That's what you can work with. You can't work with something you don't have. You work with what you have. And to adjust our race from that point where we have arrived in the heat of our progress. He will never advise us to go back to the point whence we started, as he fully knows that in that case there will be a fruitless loss of our valuable time and labor. He will direct the adjustment of the angle of the race at the point where we are. In other words, you're trying to get to that pillar. Okay, you go that way, you go that way. You can say, oh, but they're going in different directions. This is contradictory. No, because if you understand the process and what's going on, then it's there. No, everybody has to go that way. No, but then he'll get to the pillar and the other guy will end up in the pukor there. You know, so does that make sense? So that's the point. He's saying the true critic will never not. Well, maybe sometimes, or mathematically it's possible the true critic could. No, that doesn't happen. True critics won't do that. If they're doing that, they're not a true critic. He will, This is also the characteristic of the useful student. Means he's trying to get to a goal and then he'll keep readjusting until he gets it. Because the element of what we were discussing in the morning, the manana, means that you're contemplating and you're applying it. If you're not applying it, then it's not real. Right? And if you're practicing but not contemplating it, you'll never get realization. Right? So that's the point. Realization is what you want, right? That's the verse mentioned. If one has, yeah. He will read an old author and will find out his exact position in the progress of thought. Means there's one path. Krishna says there's one path. So where is this thinker in this progress? Right? And that you take what is useful, because, you know, and then start from there and move it forward. Does that make sense? He will never propose to burn the book on the ground that it contains thoughts, which are useless. No thought is useless. Thoughts are means by which we obtain our objects. The reader who denounces a bad thought does not know that a bad road is even capable of improvement and conversion into a good one. One thought is a road leading to another. Thus the reader will find that one thought, which is the object today, that will be the means of a further object tomorrow. Thoughts will necessarily continue to be an endless series of means and objects in the progress of humanity. So it may not be the absolute, but it can get you closer to the absolute. So then that means, you say, this thought will be, you know, have some object. That will get you closer. Does that make sense? So then, therefore, whatever they are, you start with that and bring them to the point of understanding the full picture, where they see the thought is how to connect it all to Krishna. Right? Then there's no need, you don't have to readjust them anymore. Then they become the useful student. They readjust themselves. And they will then, by that practice, they will become true critics. Right? They can help others do the same. So that's why we can take any book on anything practically, and we can read it, and we can talk Bhagavad Gita and stuff from it. We don't have a problem with that. But others do. They'll say it's something completely different. Does that make sense? We can take anything, you know, and express, you know, what's going on. Even as there, you just have to know. Means one is you get to the principle, you just talk on that. If people aren't happy, they want to hear the form that they're talking about, you also then have to know. Then if you know the Vedic series of form, what transforms into what, then you can show a natural progress. And then they'll be satisfied with the metaphysics. Does this make sense?
Does it also mean that the true critic actually constantly works in the present?
Because he's working with where you are right now.
He doesn't go to the past to to he may learn from mistakes from the past.
Yeah, or he's saying, oh, well, you're going over there. No, it doesn't matter. He's here right now. Just redirect him. You know what I'm saying? So it's just, that's the point, is that you find whatever is the shortest path between where they are and Krishna. Like that. And so for each living entity, it may be slightly different. You know? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, thinking framework. Now we can order someone to, not order to think. That person might try very hard, but not much will happen. You can order yourself to think, but not very much will happen. Effort alone is not enough. Just asking someone or yourself to think is an important step in the right direction, but it is not enough. The main difficulty faced during this thought process is the mind's inability to focus on more than one object or vishaya at a time. There is a need to separate the different thinking tasks in order to remove confusion, enabling us to direct our attention to one aspect at a time. All the Brajbasis are thinking of what? Krishna. And Krishna is the, in rasa, if we're talking about vibhava, what is Krishna? He's the Vishaya. Therefore, all the Brajbasis can think of one Vishaya. Right? If they're thinking of two Vishayas, it doesn't work. You understand? So this is the whole point, is the mind thinks of one thing. So then you're going to try to take that and, you know, you have to put it together into something so that that process becomes fruitful, right? So we can see is the point of focus, that you have to be focused on something, right? Means if you have focus, you can get what you want. So where does this concept of focus come from? Right? It's coming from yoga, right? So you focus on the Supreme, you'll get the Supreme. Krishna says, whatever you think of at the time of death, that's where you go. Right? Or the Sangha Yogi, when he's in Dharana, then he focuses the mind on one point. There's nothing there, but it's on one point. When it's on one point, then he starts Dhyan, which means then he sticks the Soprasol at that point. Does that make sense? It's mechanical, but it works. Right? So the idea is that when you focus on one point, you'll get something. So anyone who focuses on one point, like the big businessman who's very wealthy, what's he focused on? Business, money, or the prestige that comes with it. Something he's focused on, and that's his drive, that he does all the other activities in connection with that one focus. Therefore, he's successful. The person, well, I don't know whether I should do this or that, or maybe even that whole thing's stupid. Maybe I should do, you know, actually be situated over there. And, you know, why are we here in Los Angeles anyway? Maybe we should move to New York. But then some people say the fastest going place is Houston. I'm not Houston. That was the fastest place. Then it was, you know, Tucson, you know, but now, you know, even that's not, now they say Chicago. So, I mean, you know, we should be someplace where it's happening. So, you know, what do you know what I'm saying? So it's wherever you are, whatever you're doing, that's what's happening for you. You know what I'm saying? Then you're focused, you do something. Does that make sense? So that's the whole idea, is that is you're trying, therefore, the idea, the Vedic idea is create focus by creating a structure through which you can therefore identify what are the elements of the thought process. Otherwise it can go off anywhere. Does that make sense? Right? So no thought is bad, but still those thoughts should be focused. Right? There's a need to separate the different thinking tasks in order to remove confusion, enabling us to direct our attention to one aspect at a time, thus creating a structure which allows free, focused, and progressive flow of thought. Right? Notice here, free, focused, progressive, flow, like that, you know, all nice words. We need thinking techniques and methods. It is when we apply these with skill and effort that we get results. What's skill and effort?
Bodha.
Huh?
Bodha.
Bodha, right? Mm-hmm. Or in the other in the Upanishadic?
Manana,
right? So, you know, this is what I mean is finding things like that. You see, we need techniques and methods. Okay, so we need them, the technique and methods. So getting that, what's that called? No. Means not taking that as that. That means when you've attained it. We're talking about the process of trying to get. Because you want to apply these with skill and effort. So you need thinking methods, techniques and methods in the first place. So what is that in the educational process? Shravana, right? Or what's the other one?
Aditi.
You understand?
Yes.
So right here is that we've just think. It means here, thus creating a structure which allows free, focused and progressive flow of thought. That's your identity. Yes, I am a free thinker. I am focused. I am progressive. I am thoughtful. Right? Then what are you going to do that? I need to get techniques and methods. Right? Then, so that's your shravana. It is when we apply these skills and efforts, we get results. Right? Skill with effort. So then you have the knowledge, you apply it. You understand? That's how we get things. It's just, in other words, words have many meanings. So you have to be able to see those meanings. Otherwise, by our conditioning, we only see certain meanings. But that's why Vichara is there, the Vedic is there, to broaden your understanding of the meanings. Right? Otherwise, why look at the two things? Why look at this element of the same exact explanation from the Naishadam, right? That's a play. I think it's either a play or it's a history of, you know, Maharaj Nala. Right? So Nala and Damayanti, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a history about them or a play about them. But in there, then it's bringing out different aspects. That's the vichar of what it means to hear. Right? So one is you're here, but the other is explaining that you're trying, making that endeavor to get that knowledge. Otherwise, say, I hear, okay, I heard, okay, went in one ear, out the other, right? Like, what's his name? I think it was I think it was Gopal Bhan. Well, either one of them, Tenali Ram Gopal Bhan. I think it's a Gopal Bhan story. I think it's a Gopal Bhan story because here they make these terracotta dolls and figures and all that. Well, I think they make them in the South also, whatever. So somebody came and brought three terracotta dolls, you know, people, to the king. Must have made them very nice and he placed them in front of the king. And, you know, as an offering to the king. And the king was, you know, pleased with, you know, his citizen and all that. Then afterwards, after the formalities, then he turned to his court jester. He says, now you tell me which of these three is the most intelligent. Right? So there's the court jester. In other words, you have fun with him. You know, in other words, the king is always trying to goof on the court jester, and the court jester has the right to, within reason, goof on the king. Right? You know, of course, there's always a risk there, you know, like that. So then, you know, it's said that the court jester's heads are not necessarily so as firmly fixed to their shoulders as others, you know, may be. So there's always the risk of it falling off. So then Gopal Bhant said, okay. And he went out, and the king's running, because, you know, it's a joke, you know, and he's taking it very seriously. And he goes out, and he goes, you know, these coconut brooms, right? So they have that coconut frond. You know, it's very thin at one end and thicker at the other. So he gets a broom, breaks one of those off, and he comes back with that. Now the king's really, you know, what's going on. So he goes to the first one, and he puts the coconut, you know, frond thing into the ear, one ear, and it goes out the other ear. Okay, then he pulls it back. Then he goes to the second doll, and he puts it in the ear, and then it bends and comes out the mouth. Then he goes to the third ear, third one, and sticks it in the ear, and then it gets stuck. So he says, "My lord, this third doll is the most intelligent." Now the king really thinks the guy's crazy. You know, he says, "Since the Torah got the dolls, you know, hello." So then he says, "You know, what is this? What are you joking about? Why are you wasting my time?" He says, No, this is very serious." And the king is, "What do you mean serious?" Okay, so if it's serious, then, you know, then when you do that, then the kings, they get upset. And they say, "Okay, you said it's serious, you have to now prove it. You've said this is there, I was joking. Now you're saying it's serious, now you better prove it, otherwise you're in trouble." Right? So then he says, "No problem, I'll explain." Says the first doll, you put the whatever he hears, it goes in one ear, it goes out the other. So, you know, not intelligent at all. Nothing sticks. The second one, whatever goes in his ear comes out his mouth. So he never even thinks about it. He just gossips and talks and all that, the jalpa. But the third one, what goes in, sticks. So he's contemplated in that. So he's the most intelligent. Then the king, okay, yes. Does that make sense? So therefore, you say you hear, but that means you hear with diligence, with interest, with attention, you know, with trying to accomplish and understand that knowledge. That's all inherent in the word hear. But some people may not catch that. Therefore, they say hear, and yes, I heard, you know. But it's a matter of, so therefore these other angles of vision are brought out to broaden your understanding what hearing means. Or if they say, or looking at it in the inverse, that you're making the endeavor to get that knowledge. Okay, so now you can just go out, get some books, go on the internet, try to get some knowledge. But where is the authority? So when you say hear, means you're hearing from authority, a shabda. So therefore, make your endeavor for knowledge by approaching authority. Right? And the other one is, having approached authority, make the endeavor to actually gain something from there. Does that make sense? So by these, just these two, then you get a very clear picture of what that position that they're talking about of shravana, what it means. Right? We say hearing, chanting. What did you hear? You know. So what does that mean, hearing? What does chanting mean? What does remembering mean? So that's what vichar is for, seeing it from different angles. So that means then these words have so many meanings. And you see that there's patterns. Why does this make sense? Because it's following the Vedic formulas. Right? But it's using words that aren't necessarily technically that. If we always technically use those words, then it makes it easier. We can understand, oh, there's that consistency. But then there's also the thing, then it carries a certain flavor, which may be okay, but at the same time, maybe not. Just like we see in Srila Prabhupada's books, he explains extremely technical, fine points, but he uses common words. Like that. So because of that, then many think that it's not technical, because other translators many times will use very technical words. So only if it's a word that can't be translated, there's no equivalent, and you know, you can just train to be like achman, you know. Sometimes you'll say, you know, touch water or sip water. You know, but if you say touch water, devotees just think you just touched it. But touch means you mean to sip it, you gotta put it in your hand. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Otherwise, how do you sip? Right? Sip means is a touch. Then, does that make sense? So, these inherent meanings within it, in other words, you've heard from authority, but then there's the anuman, what's inferred, and then there's the pratyaksha, what is actually applied, what you can see. Right? So, one gains those from this, then one can see. That makes sense? So that's why in the morning we're going through all those wordings so that we understand this method. Because it could be coming from any one angle or another, depending upon what scripture it is, who it's being talked to, what is the time, place, and circumstance. Right? To a person who is cultured, knows the process of devotional service, knows the process of surrender to the guru, you simply say, first you hear from the spiritual master. That's all you have to say. For the person who doesn't do that, but maybe, you know, very submissive and all that, but doesn't actually understand the process of study, then the end service may not do that, so you have to explain it to them. So you'd use a different definition. You have to go to the class, try to get, understand, involve yourself, you know, participate. Right? So if I use all these things of, you know, class participation and trying to get everyone involved and all, it sounds very good, right? It sounds, very progressive. I just say, yes, you come and you hear, oh, that's dogmatic. It's the same thing. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing, is that it's just different angles of perception on the same thing. Right? So that's vichara. That can be accommodated, then you can find what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about. You find what's useful, how to apply, how to make that thought useful. Right? So he's saying nothing's useless, but that means, it doesn't mean that the way the person's applying it is useful, but it means the true critic can take something that is not, that means he can take anything and make it useful. Does that make sense? Like that. I was just going to say, as a joke, therefore Prabhupada took hippies, which are generally thought of as useless, and made them useful. Right? Like that. So Mimamsa analysis. The Mimamsa Shastra describes a method of analysis of the Vedic mantras. In the Vedas, there are various topics, and the method of analyzing them involves raising doubts regarding the meaning of a particular mantra. A viewpoint which attempts to explain the meaning of a mantra is then presented logically. The next step consists of pointing out the fallacies in the logic given, and then the true meaning of the mantra is established. Right? So in other words, Mimamsa is how do you interpret the verse, right? We mentioned before this hermeneutics, is that what is your approach to analyzing? So that's what makes the difference between a Gaudiya, you know, and let's say a Sri Vaishnav. Right? It's basically how they'll analyze. So many things will be common because they're all following the Vedas, so there'll be a commonality there. Within that, then they're following Vaishnavism, Uttari Mamamsa. There's a commonality there. Then within that, Vaishnavism, so there's a commonality there. Then after that, it gets more specific because you're seeing the Supreme Lord from the perspective of Vrindavan. They're seeing the perspective from Vaikuntha. Someone else is, from Ayodhya. Does that make sense? So that's what makes, so you have to be able to interpret in that way. Otherwise, there won't be a consistency. It'll get all messed up. So therefore, then the Mimamsa means that's your six systems of philosophy. Is what is your method for analyzing the verse, right? If we say it says eternal, you know, you go to that realm of eternal happiness. The Shastra will say that. So how do you interpret that? What will we say that means? Where is the realm of eternal happiness? Yes, Goloka means the spiritual realm, right? But the impersonalist will say it's the Brahman. And the Karmakandis will say that's the heavenly planets. Right? Does that make sense? So that's Mimamsa. So therefore, you'll interpret everything according to into that way. That's why it's so important to approach the acharyas. Right? From the spiritual master, you approach the acharyas. Because that way, then, you know what is the line of thought. Because their line of thought, parampara, goes back to Krishna. So you want Krishna, you have to follow their line of thought. You want Vaikunthapati, you follow another line of thought. So that's the whole idea. That's why Mimamsa is important. Does that make sense? Yeah. So what makes us Gaudiya, then, is very key. Yukta Vairagya is true, but we can connect everything, right? As Bhaktivinoda Thakur is mentioning, that's a very nice definition also what he's saying in Yukta Vairagya. But the point is yukta vairagya means you can connect everything, even dotis. Right? So the, you know what I'm saying? So many of those are into yukta vairagya means you can connect anything that's not Vedic to Krishna. But anything Vedic, oh, that's Maya, and you know, we don't care about that. So that's not yukta vairagya. That's, they've gotten the aspect of yukta vairagya, why not make it full and complete? Does that make sense? Like that. So then you're able to connect everything to your philosophy because you know how to interpret it. Right? Does that make sense? So this is what this is philosophy. How do you interpret, you know, anything? Right? So it's not theory, it's your vision. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So then we'll stop here for today. We'll continue tomorrow. We'll get into the details, means, you know, to finish the definitions, and then we'll get into the practical application. Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki.
Jai.
Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki.
Jai.
Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.
Hari Hari Bol.
Nice stuff. I should say, ash stuff.